Dwyer motioned for one boy to come forward.
"Yeah, that's right. You. Don't worry, I won't bite."
He squatted down in order to seem less imposing. The boy, a filthy urchin, looked like one for whom bravado was as important as life. Dwyer knew the type. With others watching, the lad would rather die than let himself show fear. Puffing his chest out, the kid took several steps toward Dwyer, glancing back to make sure his courage was being noted.
"What a fine young man," Dwyer commented. "And what would your name be?"
The boy looked nonplussed, as if no one had ever asked him that before. Didn't everybody in the world grow up knowing each other's names?
"Well, never mind," Dwyer said, aware the throng was growing larger as curiosity overcame dread. "I want you to run an errand for me. If you do, I'll give you something special, understand?"
"Good. Please go to Reddy. Tell her someone she knows is waiting for her."
Dwyer turned and pointed the way he came.
"Over there, by the trees. Can you remember that?" The boy nodded. Already, calculating avarice had replaced fear.
"What'll I get?"
Dwyer pulled a single arrow from his quiver. It was made by the best fletchers in Ovum Town, perfectly straight, with a tip of razor-sharp, buoyer metal that gleamed in the sunshine. The boy reached out, but Dwyer snatched it back.
"After you bring Reddy."
Their eyes met in brief understanding. With a blasé shrug, the boy swiveled and was gone, squeezing past the crowd, shouting for all he was worth. Dwyer stood up, winked at the staring tribesmen, and began sauntering back toward the forest, whistling casually. Glancing back, he saw a good part of the clan following at a distance. So far, so good.
"Oh, hell," he cursed when he saw the Glavers. "Get out of the way, will you?"
They had finished browsing at the rotten log, and now sauntered toward him. Dwyer worried. When they saw the villagers, might they panic and bolt toward the prisoner's pen? The female Glaver turned one globe-like eye toward the approaching crowd. The other eye then followed, a sure sign of concern. She snorted, and her mate reared backward in surprised dismay. They whirled and fled in exactly the direction Dwyer feared. With a tracker's sense of light and shadow, he noted Jen and Whirly crouching by a tree where the forest came nearest the prison corral. One of Dwyer's objectives had been to attract notice away from there. He had the bow off his shoulder and an arrow drawn, when Mudfoot suddenly reared out of the tall grass, waving its forepaws in front of the Glavers, hissing. The Glavers skidded to a halt and reversed course with astonishing spryness, cantering away with the Noor yipping close behind. For some reason, the locals found all of this terrifically funny. Didn't seem to matter that they had never seen a Noor before. They guffawed, pointing and laughing uproariously at the Glaver's distress, clapping as if Dwyer had put on a show for their benefit. He turned around, grinning as he reslung the bow. Anything to keep their regard riveted this way. Abruptly, the crowd fell silent as a shadow fell across Dwyer. A low, eerily familiar whine raised shivers up his spine. Shading his eyes against the sun, he looked up toward a hovering black shape, all jutting angles and hanging tendrils, like a certain demon that still haunted his dreams. The fire-spitting monster that had finished off the old Mulk spider of the mountains. Despite a penumbral glare surrounding it like a fierce halo, he made out the same octagonal symmetry. Only this one wore a rounded silhouette, perched on one jutting shoulder.
"So, you made it all the way here after all," the silhouette commented.
Not bad for a Slopey. You're no fluff baby, I guess. Though the trip seems to have wore you down to a rag man. I seen you look better, Dwer.
Thanks, Reddy, he said, edging aside so the sun would not blind him. He also wanted to get closer to the forest. You, on the other hand, never looked so good. Been taking it easy? She answered with a curt chuckle that sounded husky, as if she hadn't laughed a lot lately.
I turned down the offer your sages made to have me hike all the way back here afoot, guiding a bunch of geeps. Why walk, I figured, when I can ride?
Now he could make her out clearly. Except for the old scar, she seemed quite made over, as they said in certain parts of Tarricktown. Yet the same sullen wariness lay in her eyes. It was also his first chance to have a good look at an alien machine. 8 even rectangles made up its sides, black, without highlights, as if sunshine had trouble glancing off it. Below, a pair of tendril arms dangled menacingly on either side of the globe that was studded with glass facets and metal tubes. Danil had warned him to watch out for that globe. On top, where Reddy sat in a lashed-on saddle, the robot's surface looked flat, except for a spire rising from the center. An antenna, Danil had identified it. Dwer nodded toward the hovering machine.
Seems you've been making new friends, Reddy.
The girl laughed again, a sharp bark.
Friends who'll take me places you never saw.
He shrugged.
I'm not talking about star gods, Reddy. I mean the friend giving you a ride right now. Last time I saw one of these things, it was trying to kill us both.
She cut in.
A lot's changed since, Dwer.
And, oh, yeah, it was burning the hell out of that bird thing you cared so much about.
Ah, well, I guess sometimes it just pays better to join those who...
Shut up.
The robot reacted to its rider's anger by bobbing toward him. Retreating, he noted movement by the spherical cluster of lenses and tubes under the machine's blocky torso, turning fluidly to track him. On a hunch, Ozawa had called it a weapons pod, and Dwer's every clawing instinct confirmed the guess. A crowd gathered beyond Reddy, most of the human tribe, watching this confrontation between a ragged stranger and one of their own who had harnessed a flying devil. It must seem a pretty uneven matchup.
Some things are exactly as they seem.
Dwer caught a flash of movement toward the prison pen, Jennin making her move.
Well?
Reddy demanded, glaring down at him.
Well, what?
You sent for me, idiot. Did you hike halfway round the world just to try and make me feel guilty? Why didn't you stay away once you saw what's going on here?
I could ask you the same question, Reddy.
What are you doing? Showing off for the folks? Getting some payback? Did the star gods have some special reason to need a guide to this armpit of Jijo? Complex emotions crossed her face. What finally won was curt laughter.
Armpit. Yeah, that just about tells it all.
She chuckled again, then leaned closer.
As for what Kun is looking for, I can't tell you. It's a secret.
Reddy was a lousy bluffer.
You don't have the slightest idea, Dwer pondered. And it galls you.
So where's that pack of Slopies you were going to lead out here?
She demanded.
In hiding? I came ahead to make sure it's safe.
Why shouldn't it be? Nothing dangerous here, except maybe my nasty old cousins, and a bunch of smelly hennies.
When she said that, a piping whistle, like faint piccolo laughter, vented from a padded pouch at her waist.
And killers from outer space? Dwyer added. Planning to wipe out every thinking being on the planet?
Reddy frowned.
That's a damn lie. They ain't gonna do it. They promised.
And what if I showed you proof?
Her eyes darted nervously.
More lies. They just wouldn't do nothing like that.
Like they wouldn't shoot a poor, unsuspecting bird thing, I suppose, or attack those Urs without warning.
Reddy turned red as Dwyer hurried on.
Come along, I'll show you what I'm talking about.
Before she could refuse, he turned to walk back toward the forest.
I left it over there, behind that stump.
The girl grumbled, but followed on her robot steed. Dwyer worried that the machine might be more sophisticated than Osawa guessed. The reference works the sage had studied were 300 years out of date, and sparse on details. What if the robot both understood speech and could tell he was lying? What if it could read his thoughts? The tree stump was thicker than most. The Sooners must have worked hard with their primitive tools to hack it down when they made this clearing. Dwyer bent to pick up two things he had stashed on the far side. One, a slender tube he slid up his tunic sleeve. The other was a leather-bound book.
"What is it?"
Reddy demanded, nudging the robot to drop closer. Atop the machine's flat upper surface, there protruded short tentacle things with glossy ends. Three swiveled toward Dwyer, while the fourth watched for danger from the rear. So far, Daniel Osawa had been right about the robot's mechanical organs. If these were eyes, then that narrow spindle jutting up from the robot's center...
"Show me,"
Reddy demanded, dropping closer still, peering at the small volume, containing about 100 paper pages, a treasure from Danil's legacy.
"Oh, it's a book," she muttered with contempt. "You think you can prove anything with this? The Rothen kin have pictures that move and talk and tell you anything you want to know."
"Exactly," Dwyer thought. "They can create images to show exactly what you want to see." But he answered with a friendly nod.
"Oh, sorry, Reddy, I forgot you can't read. Well, open it up and you'll find this book has pictures, too. I'll explain them if you like."
This part had been Danil's idea. Back at Gathering, the Lesser Sage had seen Reddy flip through dozens of picture books in apparent fascination, when she felt no one was watching. Dwyer was trying to mix insult with encouragement, shame with curiosity. So the girl would have no choice but to look at this one. Wearing an unhappy grimace, Reddy reached down further and accepted the book. She sat up and riffled the paper leaves, clearly puzzled.
"I don't get it. What page should I look at?"
The robot's hover fields brushed Dwyer's leg, making all the hairs stand on end. His mouth felt dry, and his heart pounded. He fought a wave of anticipation weakness by pure force of will.
"Oh, didn't I open it to the right picture? Here, let me show it to you."
As Reddy turned toward him, the robot dropped lower. Dwyer raised his arms, reaching toward the book, but staggered when he bumped the robot's side. It was fiery death if the thing thought it was being attacked. Would the machine recognize normal human clumsiness and make allowances? Nothing happened. The robot didn't fear his touch.
"Hey, watch it," he complained. "Tell your pal here to take it easy, will you?"
"What? It's not any of my doing."
She kicked the machine.
"Leave him be, you stupid thing."
Dwyer nodded.
"All right, let's try again."
Both hands went up. His legs were like coiled springs,
and Dwar's life seemed to float above him like a sound, ready to flee on the wind. He leaped. The robot's brief hesitation ended in a sudden yowl, joined instantly by a series of sharp detonations coming from the nearby forest. Heat flared between Dwar's legs as he yanked two of the sensor heads, using them as handholds, to swarm desperately up the machine's flank, away from the deadly ball. Pain erupted along one thigh the split instant before he hauled his torso atop the gyrating machine. He clutched the bucking thing with his left hand, while his right brought forth the slender tube. The world was a blur of trees and clouds and whirling sky. More explosions pealed, accompanied by horrible, sizzling sounds. Desperately, Dwar shoved the tube at the robot's central spindle and squeezed. Traiki enzymes combined and emerged in an acrid, fizzing stream, vanishing down openings at the spindle's base. Dwar kept squirting, despite the robot's wild pirouettes, until his aim was spoiled by Reddy shoving his arm away. Only then did Dwar note her screams amid the general tumult. When her teeth clamped on his wrist, Dwar's own howl joined in. The half-empty tube escaped his convulsing hand, tumbling away. Purple steam rose from the robot's center. The spindle began to slump. Dwar shook Reddy off and, with a reckless cry, threw himself on the drooping antenna, taking it in both hands, heaving with all his might. He shouted an ululation of triumph when the whole thing tore free at the base, though it left him rolling across the flat surface, clutching futilely for a hold. Flailing, he tumbled off the edge, falling toward the meadow floor. Dwar never worried, during that brief interval, about striking some rock or jagged tree stump. The machine would likely dice him to bits before he ever hit the ground. But he was not sliced, nor did he strike the rough meadow. Blinking in surprise, he found that a pair of arms had caught him. Relief was tempered when he saw the arms belonged to the robot. Oh, great. Out of the frying pan and into the... There came another series of detonations, and the hovering machine rocked as if slammed along one side. Hanging below the octagonal body, Dwar saw part of the globe underneath explode in a spray of steel and glass. The weapons ball was already a smoking ruin. Not a single lens or tube appeared intact. Great work, Lena, Dwar thought, proud of how well she used the terrible devices that only she and a few others on the slope were trained to use. Firearms that did not use a bit of metal. He turned his head in time to see more brief flares as Lena or Danil fired again from the forest edge. The machine rocked as another exploding shell impacted. This time, one of the dangling tentacles holding Dwar shuddered and went limp. That was definitely Lena's work. What a clever girl, he thought, half dazed from pain. The sages chose well. I would have been a lucky boy if things had gone according to... He got no chance to finish the thought, as the robot whirled around to flee, zigzagging across the meadow, using his body as a shield between it and danger. Dwar saw Lena rise and take aim with her launcher, then lower it, shaking her head.
No! Shoot, damn it! He screamed. Don't worry about me!
But the rushing wind of flight carried off his words. Lena dropped her weapon and hurried to a figure lying on the ground nearby, slumped beside a second missile tube. She turned Danil Ozawa over, revealing a red river pouring from his chest. The robot's next zigging turn spun that poignant scene away. Now Dwar spied terrified villagers cowering beyond a low hill of garbage near the prisoner's pen. So dismayed were they by the battle that they seemed unaware of the group now circling around behind them, Jen and Whirly and a dozen newly released Urs.
The former captives held ropes and arbalests. Dwyer prayed this part of Danil's plan would turn out all right.
"All or nothing," Ozawa had said. "Either we live together as civilized beings, or let's end it. End it now, bringing as much harm to our enemy as we can."
Dwyer had time for one benedictory thought as Reddy's cousins grew aware of the reversal taking place behind their backs.
"Learn to be wise."
Then the village vanished as the fleeing machine streaked around a bend, whipped through a forest aisle, and plunged almost straight downhill, accelerating. Reddy was still shrieking from her perch, wailing for it to stop. From Dwyer's point of view, dangling underneath, the ground seemed to sweep by in a blur. Fighting the buffeting wind, he brought up both arms to grab the base of the tendril wrapped around his torso, holding him horizontal to the rushing terrain. If he tore it loose, the fall might kill him, but anything would be better than this torment. He tugged with all his might, but the tentacle would not budge. It flexed occasionally, yanking him up in time to miss being smashed against some boulder or shrub. Soon they were swooping beside the canyon's central stream, an obstacle course of sudden turns and bitter, stinging spray. Disorientation forced Dwyer to close his eyes, moaning. Faintness took hold, threatening to haul him the rest of the way to unconsciousness.
"Come on," he chided. "Now's not the time to give up. If you can't escape, at least check and see if you're bleeding to death."
Pain helped him concentrate, ignoring the looming vertigo. It came in a nagging medley from a searing ache in his left thigh, to Reddy's teeth marks that still oozed blood from his right hand, to the chafing rub of the robot's arm, all the way to a series of awful, biting scratches that clawed into his hip, then his abdomen, and finally his chest, as if someone were stabbing him with clusters of sharp needles, working their way up along his battered body. He opened his eyes and shrieked at the sight of a gaping mouth filled with horrible, glistening fangs.
"Oh, Hivni," he moaned. "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God."
Even when he knew the truth about the specter that loomed inches from his face, it didn't help much. At this point, and for a while longer, all Dwyer could manage was a frail, thready whimper. Mudfoot the Noor yawned a second time, then settled into the narrow space between Dwyer's chest and the robot's hard shell. The beast watched the boy, gibbering from one shock over his limit. With a sigh of affectionate scorn, it started chuddering, less to comfort Dwyer than for its own simple pleasure, making a sound somewhat like that of a hoon sailor, umbling a song about the joys of travel. Asks,
"If the common survives, if we six endure into times to come, no doubt it will be called the Battle of the Glade. It was brief, bloody, and tactically decisive, was it not, my rings? And strategically futile, an interval of flame and terror that made my, our, manicolored bands so very glad, sorrowful, that we are Traiki. Sorrowful, because these stacks of rings seemed so useless, so helpless, to match the frantic pace of other beings whose antic warlike fury drives them so quickly in a crisis, with such speed that waxy imprints cannot form within our core, except Dura's behind actual events. Sorrowful that we could not help, except to serve as chroniclers after the fact, bearing testimony to what already took place. And yet, we are also glad, are we not, my rings? Glad, because the full impact of violence never quite fills our central cavity with a searing steam of dread. Not until the action is already over, leaving the dead like smoky embers scattered on the ground. That is a blessing, is it not, my rings? To us, horror is seldom an experience, only a memory. It was not always so, not for the beings who once were, when our kind roamed the stars and were a terror on the five galaxies. In those days, creatures like us wore bright, shining rings, not only the ones given to us by our patrons, the Poa, but special collars donated by the mettlesome Oaili. Rings of power, rings of rapid decisiveness and monumental ego. Had we possessed such rings but moments ago, they might have spurred us to move swiftly in time to help our friends during the struggle. But then, if the old tales are true, those same rings might have kept us from having friends in the first place. Stroke the wax, trace the images frozen in fatty drippings. Images of atrocity and dread. There lies Bloor the portraitist, a smoldering ruin draped over his precious camera. Nearby, can we trace a slithering path of a dying creature? A symbiont crawling off the face and brow of the dead Rothan named Ropal, revealing in its wake a sharp, angular visage, humanoid, but much less so than we had thought, less charismatic, less winsomely womanlike than we were led to believe. If Bloor died for seeing this, are all eyes now accursed? There, screams Roken, ordering Ron, the star human servant, to call back the fierce sky car from its distant errand, even if it means breaking something called radio silence. There, screams Roken, once more ordering his slave demons, his robots, aloft to clear all of these away. Meaning us, all witnesses to this abrupt revelation, all who know the secret of Bloor's bane. Up, up, rise the awful instrumentalities meeting out slashing doom. From their bellies lash spears of cold flame slicing through the stunned host, turning it into a roiling, screaming mob. Four-legged Urs bound high into the air, screeching panic. Kewans cower low, trying to burrow away from rays that carve chitin as easily as flesh. Humans and Hoon throw themselves flat on the ground, while poor Gekeks spin their wheels, trying to back away. We, Treiki, those left at gathering after weeks of silent departures, mostly stand where we were, venting multi-fragranced fumes of woe, erupting wet, fear stench, as cutting beams slice through popping toruses, spilling rich liquor, setting our stacks afire. But look! Stroke the image layers one more time. My rings. See the darkly clad ones, those who rush forward toward the terror, not away. Our vision spots scry little, even by daylight, for their clothing blurs them in uncanny ways. Nevertheless, I trace squat Kewan shapes running with humans, crouched on their backs, and Urish troops sweeping alongside. There comes, as well, a booming noise, a rarely heard sound, that of lethal, hoonish ire. From their midst, these dim shapes raise strange tubes. Even as the soaring demons turn their killing rage upon the newcomers, slashing at them mercilessly. There is a place. It is here, in our core, where the wax depicts only a roar, a flash, an overload of searing afterimages, and then what followed now lies before us. Cinders. Where the robots fell to sully Jijo's holy soil, shattered and reduced to dross. Three Sky Lords, stunned to find themselves, held captive, taken prisoner, stripped of their godlike tools. A poignant field strewn with lamented dead. So many dead. A makeshift infirmary, where even more wounded writhe and grimace, crying diverse plaints of pain. Here, at last, is something we can do in real time. Perhaps they can use the assistance of an old retired pharmacist. Is it agreed, my rings? Wonderful unanimity. It makes easier the unaccustomed haste as I hurry forth to help.
Sarah. The hard march had taken nothing from the tension between the two rebel groups. Urkachu's painted warriors and Dedinger's dun-clothed hunters eyed each other warily while eating separate meals under an aged canopy of patched and weathered blur cloth, never wandering far from their weapons. Members of each group took turns sleeping after supper, no more than six at a time, while the rest kept watch. Sarah found it hard to imagine this alliance lasting a dura longer than it was in both sides' perceived self-interest. What if fighting broke out? In these close quarters, it would be no artful exercise in maneuver and strategy, but a roiling tumble of slashing, grappling forms. She recalled the frontispiece illustration in Volume 1 of the Urish Earthling Wars by Haufhutau, one of the most popular titles published since the Great Printing. In small type, the great historian acknowledged copying the scene from a Tabernacle-era art book, showing the sculpture frieze that once surrounded the Parthenon in ancient Greece. That famous relief depicted a long row of mighty figures clenched in mortal combat, naked men brawling with furious monsters, half human and half horse, who reared, kicked, and slashed at their foes in a bitter fight to the death. According to myth, the feud broke out during a festival of peace and concluded with extinction for the centaur race. Of course, an Urz had almost nothing in common with a centaur, beyond having four legs and two arms. Yet the symbolism of the frieze was so eerie, so unnerving, that it became notorious during the Age of Struggle, helping steel the resolve of both sides. Sarah had no wish to see such a bloody scene enacted in front of her. Of the others taken captive at Eryuda's oasis, young Joma was already out like a snuffed candle, curled in his bedroll, fast asleep. The stranger picked away at his meal of corn mush, frequently putting down his spoon to pluck a series of soft notes from his dulcimer, or else performing the ritual of counting its strings. Numbers, it seemed, were like music to him, a window to what he once had been, more faithful than the knack at sentences that he had lost. Kurt the Exploser doodled on his notepad, occasionally picking up one of the little books he kept so secretively, either in his valise or the inner pocket of his gown.
He covered his work, whatever any human or errs passed close, but seemed not to mind that Pretty lingered nearby after bringing his meal. Putting on her best I'm just a dumb critter act, Pretty spent some time pretending to inspect her leg for lice. But soon the little chimp was peering over the exploser's shoulder, rubbing her chin, drawing her lips past her gums, exposing a grin of silent, delighted interest. Sarah had to squelch and urge to laugh out loud. At the same time, she worried. The Urantai and Desert Man are politely leaving Kurt alone for now. The habit of deference to explosers runs deep and is hard to break. But they also promised persuasion when we reach our destination. Does Kurt really imagine he can keep his work secret, then? He'd be better off throwing his notebooks into the fire. Sarah restrained her own curiosity. Explosers were a mysterious, formidable sect. Frankly, she doubted the wisdom of the Urantai in messing with them.
"We won't wait till nightfall before setting forth,"
Ulgor told Sarah, passing near her bedroll.
"I'd catch off and sleep if I were you."
The Urish tinker's unpainted pelt, well-kept mane and piercing black true eyes set her apart from her wild cousins. There was no air of antagonism, no anti-human hostility. After all, Ulgor had visited Dolo village dozens of times, always on friendly terms. Sarah shook her head. "I can see what drives the others. Religion can be a strong motive when you think your descendant's salvation is at stake. But what do you get out of all this, Ulgor? I know it can't be profit." The narrow, conical head split in a triangular grin. Sarah did not need a rauk to know the expression was sardonic.
"Why exclude the overt reason? Earnings, personal gain."
Sarah quoted scripture. "What use will be all your wealth and goods 2 leagues down redemption's road?" Ulgor breathed a soft whistle of laughter.
"Little good at all. On the other hoof, hero status can be useful in a clan of savages. Perhaps I will be one of the great chiefs of the plains, higher in renown than Urchon."
Ulgor's self-mocking tone dismissed that idea while encouraging Sarah to keep guessing. Sarah suddenly felt tired. "You're right, Ulgor."
"You think so?"
"Indeed, I do. It would be a good idea to catch up on sleep while I can." The tinker stared, twisting her neck a half spiral.
"I thought you wanted to know."
Sarah covered a yawn. "Please be assured, Ulgor, that I am very sorry I asked." With that, she turned away to lie down on her bedroll. Pretty hurried over to tuck the blanket around Sarah, then chuffed at Ulgor, shooing her away. Sarah listened to the urbane trader's hooves pound a nervous retreat, as if burdened by Sarah's contempt. She really was exhausted. Her muscles throbbed from several days' unaccustomed exertion, and her tailbone from jarring contact with the hard leather saddle. And there was an emotional element. "I was given a job to do, several of them. Now it looks like I won't complete even one." A low, repetitive thrum pervaded the pavilion, like the synchronous, pulse-like snoring of the Urs. It was the stranger, plucking his dulcimer's lowest string, so softly and regularly that no one, not even Urkachu might find any cause for complaint, creating a lulling rhythm resembling less a heartbeat than the rise and fall cadence of rib cages, both Urish and human, as members of both parties slept.
Ariana figured he'd develop new skills to compensate for those he lost, she thought. I guess this musical sensitivity is part of that.
Just after dawn, while the two radical groups worked to set up camp, the spaceman had played for the Urish males, briefly released from the close confines of their wives' pouches, taking advantage of the break to stretch their legs in the fresh air. A few males kept close watch on maturing larvae, with six short legs and no arms, almost ready to be spilled onto the plains and fend for themselves. Using two curved mallets to strike the dulcimer strings, the stranger had accompanied himself as he sang a chain of children's melodies, familiar enough to flow smoothly from undamaged memory. Sarah even recognized a few. Among the rest, one seemed especially apropos.
I had a little husband, no bigger than my thumb. I put him in a pint pot, and there I bid him drum. I bought a little handkerchief to wipe his little nose, and a pair of little garters to tie his little hose.
He repeated the verse several times, and soon under his encouragement, the males were beating time to the song, crooning along. Sarah recalled thinking, if he wound up stranded on Jijo and had no future in any other profession, the fellow could certainly find employment in one of those modern Tarrick Town daycare centers.
If we still have such luxuries when all this is done.
Pretty plopped herself in front of Sarah. Sniggering softly, the little chimp flattened a patch of sand and began drawing figures with a stick, mostly convex, parabola-like shapes that climbed, turned over, and fell once more to zero. Pretty chuffed and pointed, as if eager to share a joke. But Sarah could not concentrate. Fatigue overcame the throbbing of her abused body, drawing her down to helpless slumber. She dreamed of Urchachka, world of grass, its plains whipped endlessly by hot winds, seared by frequent fires, or else swept by scorching rains of glittering volcanic dust. After each scalding episode, the plains seemed strewn with ashy death, yet bright stems always burst forth in prolific flashes, pushing skyward fast enough to be tracked by a patient eye. On busy Urchachka, water seldom stayed long on the ground. Life sucked it up, caching it in buried tuber reservoirs that meshed across whole continents, or else in bulbous, multi-hued spore pods, or in the lush grass stems themselves. These, in turn, were browsed by herds of grazing beasts, nervous brutes whose three-pronged horns used to wave threateningly toward danger, till they found themselves tended in great herds, protected by creatures more formidable than any past predator. In the matter of dreams, Sarah dwelled concurrently both within and outside the images. At one level, her mind's eye peered through a forest of waving fronds, feeling wary and fearful, alert to dodge being trampled by the great beasts, or worse, being gobbled by accident in their ever-crunching maws. Holes in the fecund loam led down to underground warrens, a lightless, crowded realm of sweet roots and frequent violent encounters, a domain that had lately begun to seem all too cramped, confining. The world of light above now appeared paradise by comparison, for those large enough to snake their necks above the tips of wafting grass. With a slim, detached portion of her mind,
the fragment that knew she was dreaming. Sarah marveled at the power of imagination, a gift allowing her to inflate what little anyone on Jijo knew about Urchachka from terse entries in pre-landing encyclopedia, plus a few fables passed by Urish storytellers. Tales about days before their fallow breed was discovered on its torrid homeworld, by a patron race who dropped from the sky to claim that strain of clever herders, guiding them upon the rising path, the road of uplift toward the stars. The detached part could observe, but had no other power over a fantasy like this one. A color dream, potent, forceful, and emotional. A fey phantasm with momentum all its own. A vision of clouded, insentient paranoia. Darting between bulbous stems, evading the big, dumb herbivores, she followed a smell of drifting smoke and came upon the trampled circles surrounding a smoldering pit of ashes, with a crowd of lanky, four-legged figures lounging around its rim. She peered cautiously at the big ones. Only lately had she recognized them as larger versions of herself, older cousins and aunts, instead of dangerous horrors with flashing hooves and alarming tempers. Now she spied on them, creeping closer, fighting an ever-growing temptation, an urge to step forward out of the grass and announce herself. She had seen others do so from time to time, other small ones like herself, shaking off the dust of their burrows and stretching out their necks, boldly moving to assert their claim, their birthright to a place by the fire. About a third of those who did so were ignored, then tolerated, accepted, and finally welcomed into the tight web of intermeshing loyalties. The rest did not meet happy ends. There seemed to be a trick of timing involved, a ritual of twisting necks and groveling abasement that varied from group to group. Then there was smell. It was best to approach a band that had a good aroma, one like your own. Stealing closer, she watched the party of adults, some with pouches that squirmed with lucky males who had found safe refuge from the dangerous world. Dimly, she recalled having once lived in such a place, but now she was much too big. The adults lay sheltered by tall stems from the beating sun, resting with their long necks curled round upon their backs. Now and then one of them snorted when her breathing fell briefly out of phase with the others. The third eye, the simple one without lids, kept watch. Overhead a swarm of tiny flying things hovered in parasitic avarice, wary for any chance to dive and briefly suck at an exposed lip or pouch flap, or even a blood-rich eyelid, and get away again before quick hands or jaws snapped. Sarah watched as one unlucky bug was snatched before landing. In a fluid motion, the adult popped the buzzing bloodsucker into her mouth, crunching away without bothering to rouse from her slumber. "I don't recall diving insects when I read about the Ur's homeworld," pondered the detached part of Sarah's drowsy mind, "or in any tale of Urchachka." Gradually it dawned on her that she wasn't making it all up. Rather, her unconscious was borrowing from events in the real world. Her eyes were open just a crack, and through the dreamlike diffraction of her interlaced lashes, she was watching actual Urs do what she had thought, she imagined. As before, half of the Urantai lay curled on sandy wallows, breathing with uncanny unison under the blur-cloth canopy. Nothing seemed much change from when she had last gazed at her captors, but then something happened that correlated eerily with her dream. A low buzzing sound, accompanied by whizzing motion through the air. A small insect-like object darted from left to right toward one of the dozing Urs. In a flash, the sleeper snatched the hurtling speck out of the air with her gaping, three-jawed mouth, chewing contentedly with both main eyes still closed. The central one, unlidded and faceted, retained the glassy dullness of full sleep as the warrior settled back down, snoring heavily.
"I've never seen that happen before," Sarah pondered. "Are there bugs here in the foothills that attack Urs like those on their homeworld?"
Taut, bowstring tension ran up Pretty's spine as the little chimp edged backward, pressing against Sarah with an elbow. Sarah slowly lifted her head to scan the Urantai. Those awake fondled their arbalists and switched their tails nervously, as if beginning to suspect that something was wrong. Their long necks stretched, waving left all at the same time, then at Dettinger's desert men, and onward to the right. When they turned away again, there came another low, twanging buzz, so familiar it almost seemed unnoticeable. Once more, a small shape sped toward a dozing Urs. Again it was snatched from the air and consumed without rousing the sleeper. Sarah followed the arc of that brief flight backward across the tent to where the stranger sat at his dulcimer, still plucking at the lowest note, creating a steady, hypnotic rhythm. The rauk, draped over his eyes, only partly masked an enigmatic smile. Sarah realized two others were watching the Starman, Dettinger and Kurt the Exploser. Sniffing at the humid air, Urkachu motioned for Ulgor to join her outside. The four painted warriors on duty went back to tending their weapons. The stranger bided his time, softly plucking the string. He kept up a slow, soothing cadence until the wary Urantai guard settled back down. Then with his left hand, the stranger touched the side of his head and slipped two fingers under the filmy covering provided by the rauk, reaching into the hole in his head, Sarah realized, with a touch of nausea. When the fingers emerged, they held a tiny object, a pellet, about the size of one of the message balls used in the Byblos library. While his right hand plucked the string another time, his left brought the pellet forth, poising it for the next stroke. "He's using the dulcimer as a launcher," Sarah realized, watching in fascination. She noted a slight difference in the sound, a buzzing dissonance as the tiny pill spun through the air toward another sleeping Urish rebel. It missed this time, dropping half a body length short of the target. Dettinger was in motion, surreptitiously nudging his comrades, using furtive hand signs, telling them quietly to prepare. "He doesn't know what's going on, but he wants to be ready when the pulp hits the screen." The tent flap opened, and Urkachu re-entered without Ulgor. The chieftain sauntered over to one of the sleeping Urantai and prodded her, an action that normally would have a wiry Urs on her feet in an instant. But there was no response. The raider kept on snoring. Alarmed, Urkachu began jabbing, then kicking the sleeping warrior. Others hurried over to help. In moments it grew clear. Of eight who had gone down to sleep, all but two were lost in a soporific stupor. The dulcimer twanged again, and several things happened at once. Urkachu swiveled angrily and shouted in Anglic,
"Stuff that infernal racket now!"
Meanwhile, a tiny object sailed over the dying coals toward the confused warriors. One of them snapped reflexively, taking it with her jaws. Almost instantly, her nostril flared, and her neck stretched to full extension, trembling along its length.
The Urs began to wobble at the knees. Sarah would not have thought she could react so fast, scrambling backward with Pretty, gathering up the blanket-swathed Joma, hauling the sleeping boy to the rear of the tent. Swift as ghosts, Dettinger's men were already deploying in a crescent, surrounding the Urantai with arrows knocked and drawn.
"What's going on?"
Joma asked, rubbing his eyes. The wobbly Urs drifted to one side, fell against another, and collapsed, rib cage heaving slowly, heavily.
"Remain calm," Dettinger announced. "I urge you to lay down your weapons. You are in no condition to fight."
Urkachu stared blankly, dismayed by the sudden reversal of power. Her group had outnumbered the humans, but now her remaining followers stood in a cluster, unready, at the Earthling's mercy. The Urantai leader growled.
"So, in this perfidious treason, the nature of human so-called friendship is revealed."
"Yeah," Dettinger laughed a little smugly. "As if you planned things any different when the chance came. Anyway, there is no cause for panic over this. We'll still keep our side of the bargain, only as senior partners, with a few slight changes, such as the destination for tonight's march. Once there, we'll let you send a message."
He might have meant to sound soothing, but the words only infuriated Urkachu, who cut in with a shrill battle cry, hurling herself toward Dettinger, unsheathed knives flashing.
"No!"
screamed the stranger, in an outburst of reflex horror as feathered shafts sprouted from the thorax of the Urantai leader.
"No, damn it, damn it, damn it!"
Urkachu's remaining followers followed her example, charging into a hail of arrows. Half were riddled during the first half-dura. The survivors leaped among their bipedal foes, slashing and drawing some blood before being dragged down by weight of human numbers. Finally, with no living Urantai left on their feet, the panting, wild-eyed desert men began turning their knives on the unconscious ones, those whose drugged stupor never let them take part or defend themselves. To the stranger, this was the final straw. Screaming curses, he threw himself on the nearest human, throttling his neck ganglia. The hunter struggled briefly, then sagged with a moan. The starman leaped at another, hurling streams of epithets. Sarah pushed Joma toward the tent flap and cried,
"Pretty, take him to the rocks."
In the blurry muddle of split instants, she saw three of Dettinger's hunters turn and assail the stranger. One tumbled away, tossed by some tricky twist of the alien's body, while another found himself suddenly burdened with a new problem. Sarah, hammering at his ribcage from behind. "If only I listened when Dwar tried to teach me how to fight." For a moment, things went well. Sarah's short but burly adversary groaned and turned around, only to catch her knee in the gut. That didn't stop the hard-muscled hunter, but it slowed him, letting Sarah get in two more blows. Meanwhile, the stranger threw his remaining foe aside in a dazed heap and started to turn, coming to her aid. The avalanche hit then, a tide of male human wrath that dragged both of them down. Sarah struck ground with enough force to knock the breath from her lungs. Someone yanked her arms back, and sharp agony made her gasp, wondering if the limbs were about to tear off.
"Don't harm them, boys," Dettinger commanded. "I said ease off."
Distantly, through a muzzy fog of pain, she heard blows landing as the former sage slapped and hauled his men back from the brink of murderous revenge. Desperately, Sarah managed to swing her head around to see the stranger, pinned down, red-faced, and bleeding from the nose, but well enough to keep up a faint, hoarse stream of inventive profanity. The outpouring was as eloquently expressive, though not quite as fluent, as song. Sarah worried that shouting and straining so hard might reopen his injuries. The leader of the human rebels knelt by the stranger, taking his face in both hands.
"It's too bad you can't understand me, fella. I don't know what you did to the Urs, but I truly am grateful. Made a complicated situation simple is what it did. For that reason, and because your living carcass is still valuable to us, I'll hold back my guys. But if you don't settle down, I may be forced to get unpleasant with your friend here."
With that, he nodded pointedly at Sarah. The stranger glanced at her too, and somehow seemed to grasp the threat. His stream of scatological curses tapered, and he ceased heaving against the men holding him down. Sarah felt relieved that he stopped straining so hard, and strangely moved to be the reason.
"That's better," Dettinger said in the same smooth, reasonable voice he had used before Urkachu's fatal charge. "Now, let's take a look at what you've got hidden in that handy little hole in your head."
The ex-sage began to peel back the stranger's rauk, revealing the wound from which he had taken the mysterious pellets.
"No!" Sarah shouted, despite sharp pain when two men yanked her arms. "You'll give him an infection."
"Which his star friends will cure, if they so choose, once we make our exchange," Dettinger answered. "Meanwhile, this stuff he was feeding the Urs seems worth looking into. It could prove powerfully handy during the years ahead."
Dettinger had finished pulling back the rauk and was about to insert his hand when a new voice broke in, whistling a trill stream of rapid galactic two.
"Sarah, I earnestly urge you to swiftly close your eyes."
She turned her head and glimpsed Kurt, the Tarik Town Exploser, holding a small brown tube. A burning string dangled from one end, giving off sparks at a furious pace. The Exploser cranked his arm back and threw the tube in a high arc, at which point Kurt dove for cover. Sarah squeezed her eyes shut tight as Dettinger began to shout a warning to his men. A flash like 1,000 lightning bolts filled all reality, stabbing through her eyelids. At the same instant, roaring noise shook her like a bird in a ligger's jaws, rolling the mass of sweaty men off, releasing her twisted arms so that waves of relief clashed with agonizing sensory overload. It was over almost the moment that it happened, except for howling reverberations rebounding off the stony pillars that now could be seen towering over the shredded tent. Or perhaps they were shock waves hammering inside her own head. Hurriedly, she fled the tangle of screaming men who clutched their useless eyes. Blinking past purple spots, she made out one other human who could stand and see. Dettinger, who would also have understood Kurt's brief warning. The desert prophet peered ahead while holding forth a gleaming blade of Buyer metal. He yelled past the bedlam in her ears and charged at Kurt, knocking the old man down before the Exploser could bring a new weapon to bear. Sarah recognized a pistol from pictures in ancient texts.
"So much for Exploser neutrality," Dettinger shouted, twisting Kurt's arm until the old man groaned and the weapon fell. "We should have searched you, and tradition be damned."
Overriding pain, Sarah tried to spring at the ex-sage, but he lashed out with a savage backhand, knocking her down amid a swirl of spinning stars. Consciousness wavered. Only gritty resolution let her rise again, turning on her knees to try one more time. There came another flash and roar as Dettinger fired the pistol just past her and then tried awkwardly to cock for a second shot before being bowled over by two hairy forms hitting him from both sides. Sarah somehow managed to fling herself into the fray,
joining Ulgor and Pretty in subduing the former scholar, whose wiry strength was astonishing for his age. Fanaticism has rewards, she thought, as they finally managed to tie Dettinger's hands and feet. Recovering the weapon, Kurt backed away, taking a rocky perch where he could watch the moaning remnants of the desert gang, as well as the surviving Urs, especially Ulgor. The Tinker's sudden return might have been fortuitous, but that would not make him trust her. A sticky sensation made Sarah stare at her hands, trying to separate red stains from vision blotches left by Kurt's stun bomb. The stains had the color and scent of blood. It isn't me, and Ulgor wouldn't bleed this shade of... It was Pretty, stanching a crimson flow from a deep gash in her side. Sarah took the trembling little chimp into her arms and fought a sudden fit of weary sobs. The wrecked tent was a horror scene of dead or delirious Urantai and flash-blinded men. The stranger seemed in better shape than most when he finally staggered to his feet. At least he could see well enough to help Ulgor bind the arms of Dettinger's crew, while young Joma returned to hobble the legs of sedated Urs. Still, it soon grew clear that the battered man from the stars could not hear a blessed sound. Against every instinct that urged her to be thorough, Sarah forced herself to make do with a pressure compress over Pretty's wound. It did not seem immediately life-threatening, and someone else might yet be saved by quick action. So with the chimp's grunt of approval, she hurried over to one wheezing quadruped, a young Urs thrashing feebly with an arrow through her neck, whose labored breathing made noisy purple bubbles, and who died with a shuddering gasp of despair before Sarah could do a thing to help her. Asks.
Battle echoes gouged the land only a few short duras ago. Firebolts lashed from heaven, scourging the six, laying open flesh, chitin, and bone. Traikes gushed molten wax across the tortured valley, or else burst aflame, ignited by searing beams. Oh, my rings! What images lay seared throughout our trembling core! The dead, the dying, the prudent ones who fled, the rash heroes who came. Their blur-cloth tunics are now grimy with mud and grew, no longer quite as slippery to the eye. Young tree farmers and donkey drivers, simple keepers of lobster pens, junior hands on the humblest fishing coracles, volunteers who never imagined their weekend training might come to this. Our brave militia, who charged into that maelstrom, that cauldron of slicing rays. Amateurs, soft and unready after generations of peace, who now wince silently, clenching their limbs while horrid wounds are dressed, or while life slips away, bearing agony with the gritty resolve of veterans, their suffering eased by the only balm that soothes. Victory! Was it only yesterday, my rings, that we feared for the commons, feared that it might fly apart in jealous hatreds fostered by crafty star devils? That dread fate may yet come to pass, along with a thousand other terrors, but not today. Right now the arrogant aliens stand captive, staring about in surprise, stripped of their godlike tools, their hellish robots destroyed by the crude fire tubes of our brave militia. A day of reckoning may not be far off. It could swoop at any moment from an unforgiving sky. Yet there is exhilaration, a sense of relief, The time of ambiguity is over. No more subtle games of misdirection and innuendo. No more pretense or intrigue. Ifni's dice have been shaken and cast. Even now, they tumble across Jijo's holy ground. When they stop rolling, we will know.
Yes, my second ring, you are right to point this out. Not everyone shares a sense of grim elation. Some see in recent events cause for nihilism, a chance to settle old grudges or to spread lawlessness across the land. One vocal minority, Friends of the Rothan, demands the release of Rokan. They advise throwing ourselves